Welcome to Christ Church Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com. My home is not on this
earth, not in this world. Prayer is on the front edge of change. So if we want to see a big change in something, then we must pray about it. We need to pray about it. Whether that is a change in your own heart about a particular situation or a habit you want to break through, or whether it's a change broadly in society. So we look at something that is going on in our world and we think, oh, that we need that to change, then we must pray about it. Or if it's a situation in families, in friendship groups, or in work, then we must pray. We must ask God and see what he says, see how he answers. And I believe, and the whole reason that we're talking about prayer is because I believe God listens and he answers. Now, the answer may not always quite be what we want for ourselves, but actually, God chooses to answer us as we pray. And to pray actually requires a great deal of courage. I think firstly to look at a situation and to decide we're going to talk to God about it and not just ignore it or not give in to cynicism, actually that requires a great deal of courage. And it also requires courage because we are asking God, creator of everything, sustainer of everything, to move. And God doesn't contain himself to our expectations and our way of doing things. Actually, I was talking to someone who's on their journey back to God just recently. He would say he went through a time of walking away and is now coming back to God. And he said, one of the things I realized that I had a problem with God was I thought God was just a big version of me. So I would look at a situation and think, I would do something about this, or I would move in this way. And he said, I realized that God actually isn't just a big version of me. He is the creator and sustainer of the universe. He is beyond our understanding. So when we talk to God, that being who is beyond us, and say, would you please move? Then actually that takes some courage, doesn't it? Because he may decide to move in a way which we weren't quite expecting. So today I want us to look at a character called Elijah, who prays actually a very courageous prayer in a very, very difficult situation. This is a back against the wall prayer. And in the context, in this situation, actually we come to a time where there is a real chance that the people of God, Israel, are going to walk away from the living God entirely. And actually it looks like they're well in the process of doing that. Worship of the living God in Israel is at the point where it could be completely wiped out. And we find ourselves about 100 years after King David, okay, one of the great kings who led a unified Israel that expanded, that was prosperous, where they worshipped and they had some problems. And we did a series on David last year, but actually it was a golden era for Israel and then Solomon as well. But now they find themselves with a divided kingdom, Israel in the north, Judah in the south, and their king is a man called Ahab. And Ahab is not good news. He worships a false god, a god called Baal, and we'll hear a bit more about Baal in a bit. And Elijah is a prophet, actually one of the famous prophets of Israel. Elijah hears from God and goes and tells Ahab, he says, there's going to be no rain, not even any dew in this nation for 3 years. 3 years you're going to experience very extreme drought. Okay, this is what God has told me. And Ahab blames Elijah for this. I mean, he clearly says it can't be God, so I'm going to blame Elijah for this. And so Elijah largely runs and hides. And 3 years later, God actually says to Elijah, right, go and tell Ahab, go find him, go tell him, okay, this guy who actually would quite like to kill you and has killed many of your friends, many of the other prophets have been killed, and he is wiping out how we worship the living God. He is removing the very purpose for Israel's existence. Go and tell this madman that actually it's going to rain again. And so Ahab goes and finds him. And we're going to go from 1 Kings 18. If you've got your Bibles, you go to verse 17. It will appear up behind me, but I prefer reading off paper. I'm just saying, I'm old school. So 1 Kings 18:17 says, when Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah, and all who eat at Jezebel's table." Jezebel is his wife. Jezebel often comes out worse in these stories, but Ahab is there and is in charge as well. So let's just remember that. So anyway, so Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between the two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us. Let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it into pieces. Lay it on wood, but put no fire on it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your gods, and I will call upon the name of the Lord's. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, "It is well spoken." Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourself one bull and prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull that was given to them, and they prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he's musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey. Perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud and then cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, which we think is probably early evening. But there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. And Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel should be your name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar, as great as would contain two seers of seeds. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill four jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. And at the time of the offering of oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are gods, and that you have turned their hearts back." Then the fire of the Lord fell, consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, he is good. He is God. The Lord, he is God." And Elijah said to him, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape." And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon and slaughtered them there. I get tingles reading that story. I think it's just an incredible story. And it's actually just immensely courageous what Elijah does here. He is way out on a limb. He is redefining what it means to be out on a limb and needs, I think, some tremendous courage. He is asking God actually to intervene in a situation that is seemingly lost. Seemingly it's done, it's all over, the game is finished. And perhaps for him, actually the easiest move is just to give up, to compromise. In the chapter before, it talks about how other prophets of the living God, were being hidden in caves. And so because they thought they were going to be killed, and actually Jezebel and Ahab were keen to kill them. But Elijah decides, actually, he needs to see God move. He wants to see God move. And so today we're going to talk about this a little bit, what it is to pray with great courage. So first of all, to understand, courageous prayer, it comes out in a society that has forgotten God. Okay, that's where they find their souls at the moment. And it's important to understand that Israel had been swept up in the worship of this god called Baal. And why had they done that? You think about it, you think, well, actually, what do we know about Israel? They had some incredible stories about the living gods, about how they had been brought out of Egypt with miracles, how they'd been brought into the promised lands with incredible miracles, how God had blessed them and multiplied them, and amazing things had happened to them. And they had this now this huge temple in the middle of Jerusalem, which was a great reminder to them of the presence of God amongst them, the living, real, active God. And yet they gave it up for this other God. Now, why would they do that? You have to think about it. Okay, well, these stories, they would have been told repeatedly and often. Why did they walk away like this? Well, actually, what we know about this time is that Jezebel and Ahab, who were the king and the queen, actually had become devoted followers of Baal. Jezebel was not an Israelite, and she worshipped other gods and convinced her husband to do the same. And actually, his dad worshipped other gods as well, and there was a lot of problems there. And so these two at the very top of society were worshipping this other god. And so it's worth pointing out that actually people follow power. People follow leaders and authority. People follow big cultural influences, which this king and queen were. The top of what society thinks and says actually does filter down, does affect people. And it may be very simply think, actually, I would like to get on in life. I would like not to die. So I am going to just try and fit in and do what these people say. If they are worshipping this god and they say anyone who doesn't is under threat, then perhaps the easiest thing to do is not to rock the boat and just go with what's happening around me. This god Baal as well is described as the god of storms and fertility. So his claim was that he would bless mankind with fruitfulness. So he is described as someone who gives oil and wine and grain. Okay, these are very affluent things to have. If you have these, you are rich, you are doing very well. And he's also the god that sends storms and fire. So storms and fire that would burn grain and oil and wine. So this is a god that you want to keep on sides. Baal worship also involved sexual immorality as well. Okay, it also involved just going with your deepest urges and desires. So to worship this other god, this false god, actually scratched where most people were itching. So his promise was, I will make you rich. If you follow me, you're going to be affluent. You're going to do very well. I promise you that. Also, you can really go with those deep urges that you have. Just go with those. There's no censure. There's no boundary. You just be who you are. Do what you want. And so the people of God fall for this. They actually begin to turn their back on the living gods. They have gone with actually what's very easy. They've gone with what's right in front of them. They've gone with what their friends and neighbours are doing. They've gone with what the people above them in society are doing as well. And actually, as we read this, as we reflect on this, you think, well, perhaps we live in a similar time. Perhaps actually it's easy to go with what those above us might do. Perhaps easy to go with what we see people around us in the way that they live. Perhaps it's just easy not to say anything and just to allow that to carry on. They live in a society that has forgotten God. But Elijah has not. In obedience, actually, he makes a big stand. He says to them, he says to the people of Israel who've been gathered there at Mount Carmel, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord actually is God, then you should follow him. But if Baal is really God, then you should follow him as well. And he calls them out, really, obviously, to follow whichever God is real. He's talking about quite a deep thing here. He's not just saying, look, you decide which one you believe and then carry on as normal. Actually, he's saying, follow. Set your life in the direction of that God. When Jesus, in the beginning of Mark, went out to get his disciples, the thing he said was, follow me. Follow. Dedicate your life to walking with me. Dedicate your life to being like me. And Israel is accused of worshipping both gods here and committing actually to neither of them. So it might be quite easy to think in black and white terms. Oh, they've just given themselves to worshipping this other foreign gods and it's quite black and white. Actually, they were doing both things. They were bouncing all over the place, limping from one to the other. And actually, walking away from gods is rarely a black and white thing. There's rarely one morning you wake up and think, you know what? I'm done. I walk away. I was radical. Now I am the opposite of that. Actually, to walk away is lots of little compromises. Slowly but surely, you give something else equal status with God's. And actually, Elijah wants them to understand this. He understands what's about to happen. He says, look, you're not going to see this incredible showdown between two gods. You don't actually get to watch this, decide that you think, okay, maybe the living God is the most real, and then carry on with life as normal. Actually, he says, no, if God is real, then follow. This means big change. This means actually your life can never be the same again. You can't carry on as we were. We can't go on with what's comfortable. We can't just allow ourselves to fit into the culture around us because we think that's the easiest way forwards. We'll just do what the people above and the people around are doing. Actually, no, we follow. We go after God. Actually, that takes incredible courage, doesn't it, to point people to God. And even to point yourself, to point out where there is compromise and to look to live in the way God would have us live. So courageous prayer, actually, as we can see, can be very lonely. So he's asking them to choose God. He makes his claim. He said, don't limp between one and the other. Follow God. And the people are silent. That's what it says. They just don't say anything. And you wonder, I was wondering this morning whether they were just looking at the floor and just, this is a bit uncomfortable, or whether it was a cold-eyed stare at Elijah. We're dead to this. They say nothing. Then Elijah says to people, I'm the only one left, aren't I? I'm the only prophet here, but he's got 450. I'm the only one. He's out on his own and he knows it. But actually, faith feels like that, really. To step out in faith, to pray this prayer of courage, actually can be a pretty lonely thing. Whether you're praying actually for a big change in your workplace, maybe there's a big cultural problem there that makes you just feel awful and you think, I need that to change. That's quite a lonely prayer, actually, because you perhaps have to live it out as well. Actually, perhaps it's in your spouse. You think that there's something going on in their life, I need that to change. I need to talk to God about a big change there. And actually, that's a very lonely place to be as well. Or in a friendship group, there's a friend who's going through something and you think, this needs to change. Actually, that can be pretty lonely too. Planting a church in a culture that is not really that interested, kind of shrugs its shoulders, that can be pretty lonely. Courageous prayer can also look irrelevant. And I wonder if Elijah felt that at all. He was on Mount Carmel and he picked this one deliberately. He picked this mountain on purpose because it was the place where they worshipped Baal. Actually, it was kind of home ground. It was like he was a boxer challenging another fighter in their hometown. Okay, and actually, ancient literature says this is where they went to worship God. And as we read that story, we see that they had to repair the altar of the living God because that had been knocked down. So he was almost on home turf of the opposition. And he was up against actually about 800 prophets. So the 450 of Baal, the 400 of Asherah, not to mention King Ahab was there as well with all of the people that and hangers-on that kings have, and the people of Israel all watching as he does that. The very quiet people of God waiting to see what happened. And you sense that if Elijah had been killed in this moment, they would think, well, we hedged our bets. We were okay. We get to carry on. And it looks really like Baal, it looks like Ahab. Actually, they have all the cards. They are without doubt the biggest show in town. They are the most important thing there. They're the thing that everybody is attracted to. They're the thing that is causing everyone to be excited. Powerful people worship Baal. The prophets of God are in hiding. The opposition are often killed. Compromise must seem like the safest way. Must seem like, actually, if I just get out of this one, at least I'm still alive. Okay, at least I can still be a believer of God, even if I'm on my own a bit. Perhaps I can just worship God quietly, privately, in my own life. Maybe that's what I do. Slowly but surely becoming irrelevant. And actually we can see this in the place that we live now, can't we? In Manchester. Actually, many people who aren't here this morning or in other churches would perhaps consider the worship of the living gods as an irrelevance, really. Just think, actually, I don't think that's relevant to my way of life, my way of viewing the world anymore. Actually, I don't think that matters to me. It's moved out to the margins. So courageous prayer can actually look a bit irrelevant. Courageous prayer also comes from the underdog. That's what we're seeing here. And actually, we Christians struggle with the idea of being the underdog, especially in Britain. You can see it play out. Christians standing up and arguing that we live in a Christian country and wanting these things back. But actually, God quite likes being an underdog. He seems to thrive in that situation. Think of Moses versus Pharaoh and the Egyptians, the most powerful nation in the world at that point in history. And God was quite happy to back a guy who'd been in the desert for 40 years and couldn't talk properly. God's happy with the underdog. Or perhaps David versus Goliath and the Philistines. Israelites under massive pressure. So God decides, actually, 12-year-old boy with a stone, that'll do me. I'm quite happy with that underdog status. Or Jesus on the cross. He was up against the people of God, the Roman Empire, and Satan himself. And yet, God is quite happy with that situation, and he wins. Courage in that place comes, even though God's the underdog, simply because he sets the rules, actually. So what we see here between Elijah and the prophets of Baal is not a competition. It's not like a God-off. It's not two fighters going against each other and it's getting close and we're not quite sure who's going to win. It's not even a bidding war, like who's got the best offer. Okay, you're going to offer us some pretty weird worship. You're the living God. What's better? It's not even that. What we quickly see is false gods and idols are dead. They are entirely absent from the conversation. They demand so much of the people of Israel and so much of us, and yet they give us absolutely nothing. Worshipping idols, giving your life to things before God, putting things above God, putting things in the place in your life where God should be, actually, they give us nothing, but they do have profound impact. Actually, we can see the impact on Israel. We see them, as Elijah says, limping between the two gods. They're damaged. They're partially less human than they should be. They are not living as God would have them, so they limp. The priests of Baal also are described as limping around the altar. That's because their gods have taken their pound of flesh, have damaged them. We see Israel, when Elijah challenges them, they say nothing. They're completely silent. Silent like their gods are silent, incidentally. Baal is silent when Elijah challenges him. Baal is silent when they pray that he would do something. And courageous prayer, actually, as well as it potentially being under pressure, looking like the underdog, but actually, courageous prayer shows the emptiness of false idols. So the priests did as he suggested, didn't they? They put the bull on the altar, they prayed for fire. In fact, they prayed all morning and nothing happens. And then there's some real comedy. Elijah saying, well, cry louder because he's clearly a god. And actually, in reading about these gods of these nations of Baal and some of Baal's relatives, which are also gods, there's one story of Baal's sister going to visit him and knocking on the door, but Baal doesn't answer because Baal's gone out for a walk. Okay, and that's the god that they worship. So he says, perhaps he's gone for a walk. Where's your god gone? This is not an all-seeing, all-powerful god. If you knock on the door and he happens not to be in, you're going to have to wait. Or perhaps he's gone to the toilet. That's what he says. He's relieving himself. Imagine the comments standing in front of all of them. He's gone for a wee. Just wait, he'll be back. He's gone for a wee. He'll be back. It is ridiculous. Perhaps he's fallen asleep. This is the god that you worship. And so they decide to up their game a little bit. Okay, well, all right, then we'll start cutting ourselves. And you think, well, no wonder you were limping around the altar. You were physically damaged and ruined by the worship of this god. You drew blood. But, it says, there was no voice No one answered, and importantly, no one paid attention. Nothing happened. They had believed a lie. They give themselves to a God that demands much for them, demands their life, demands even their blood, but actually can't hear them. A God that demands, actually, they pray with frenzy. It talks about how they raved on, how they would shout and holler and scream, and yet he paid no attention. No amount of extra religious activity or performance caused this God to do anything more than nothing. And yet Elijah, courageously, actually he points to the living God. He builds the altar, soaks the altar 3 times. You can imagine him just kind of staring at all of the prophets. You wonder if he was eyeing them, perhaps glancing round at the people of Israel. And this ditch then around it fills with water. This thing is soaking wet. And then he prays, actually, what is a very, very courageous prayer. He says, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Which you wonder if Israel were listening at that moment. He's saying, look, remember these stories that you've forgotten. Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that actually you are God, and that I am your servant, and I've done all these things at your word, which I love because there's a little bit of, come on, I have soaked the altar here. Answer me, Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and you have turned their hearts back. And it's courageous because it's asking God to move. And it's also courageous, I think, just in how he prays. I think it's fascinating. He doesn't mention Baal. He doesn't pray against him. He doesn't talk about the awful situation in Israel. He just says, God, people need to know you again. That's what they need. They need relationship with you restored. That's the important thing. That is the baseline issue here. It's not everything else. Actually, relationship with you changes everything, God. Having hearts, the very core of who we are, turned back to you. That's the game changer here, God. Nothing else. Everything else that these people have done, all of this crazy Baal worship, whatever else has happened, actually, it all changes when we know you again. When our hearts are brought back to you. And what happens? Right at the end of our story, fire falls down. The whole thing is burnt up. God actually exists. He is real. When fire falls, it makes me think, actually, the presence of God appears there in a context where the people of God look like they're walking away. Very similar to when Jesus turned up. Actually, the presence of God is there when actually Israel was under immense pressure. And Jesus is there. The presence of God is with us here in Manchester because of Jesus. Even though actually, in real terms, the church in our city is under an amount of pressure. We can look at all of the good things, and there are many good things happening in many churches in our city, and think, oh, it's okay, we're okay. But actually, the number of people that go to church or believe God is minuscule, very tiny. And yet Jesus is here, so we don't have to worry. Jesus is with us.